Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hi, listeners. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at organicgardenerpodcast.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, download our ebook on organic gardening basics, and get started on building your very own organic oasis today. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. Again, I'm super excited to introduce you to another guest I met at the Aero Conference last month. His name is Ed Evans. Oh, yeah. How do you say your last name again?
Evanson.
Okay, his name is Ed Evanson, and he gave a great speech on cottage foods. And so he's here to talk to us a little bit more about the rules in Montana for the cottage foods. And then, you know, you can kind of look maybe up the rules in your state, but just I think he will be really interesting. I think we'll learn a lot from him. So welcome to the show today, Ed.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, because I learned so much that day, and it's something, you know, we're really interested in, because my husband and I are just kind of starting out our little farm, and especially my husband's a big baker, and we just got bees for honey, and we have chicken eggs, and we're just really very small, but I was excited to hear that, like, we could sell some of his baked products without having to have a commercial kitchen, and I don't know. So I'm sure other listeners are going to be surprised. I know the regulations go by the state, but anyway, go ahead. I do always kind of like to start the show by asking you a little bit about yourself. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in the Seattle area, went to school at Western Washington University in Bellingham, got a degree there in biology, and then started working on a farm. So I worked on a farm for, I don't know how long, for a while. And
like a while, like a year, like a month, or like 5 years?
I want to say just over a year.
Okay.
Just over a year. So it was a big blueberry farm up in Linden, Washington.
Okay.
Blueberries, raspberries, and then we grew they were testing blackberries, and they were like these big pine cone sized blackberries. They were huge. I think they were, I don't know if it was the species or just because blackberries aren't usually grown with fertilizer and pesticides and all those things, but they were massive, sort of, I thought of them as sort of mutated blackberries, but so we grew all those things, and that was a pretty interesting experience, and actually got me interested in, for a number of reasons, in this concept of environmental health. So right now I work for the Food and Consumer Safety section for the state of Montana. I'm the section supervisor, and we are the, enforcers of a number of regulations, but those regulations are intended to protect the public from environmental health hazards. So on the farm, I saw a number of things. You know, chemicals being used by workers to clean things up. So that's an environmental health hazard. But then I was also dealing with food safety there. So there was, you know, I was sampling for listeria and sampling for other bacteria to make sure that the food we were producing was safe. You know, the food coming off that farm and being packaged by that farm was safe. And so that kind of got me thinking about things. And from there, I went and worked at the Skagit County Health Department, and actually worked in hazardous. And I mentioned this at the Aero Conference, that my background before coming to Montana was in hazardous and solid waste. So I worked for the Skagit County Health Department, and we did, I did like, it was called small business pollution prevention. So I went out and worked with small businesses like dry cleaners and small auto body shops, places like that that don't have a lot of resources but are still dealing with a lot of the same dangerous chemicals that some of these bigger companies deal with. The bigger companies hire professionals to handle worker safety and handle chemical exposures, and the smaller companies didn't have those resources. And so we were trying to provide that resource at the local level and help people limit or and kind of minimize their exposures to chemicals so that, you know, they could live a healthier life. And then, let's see, from there, I went to the University of Washington and got a master's in science at the School of Public Health, and I focused again on environmental and occupational health, and I studied specifically carcinogenic compounds that are found in drinking water. And then, let's see, what did I do after that? Then I worked for King County Department of Natural Resources and again did small business pollution prevention. And then my wife and I decided to move out here to Montana. And I worked for 3 years in, or 2 years in the body art program at the Food and Consumer Safety section. And then I worked in the pool program, and then I was hired as the supervisor, and the month after I was hired, the cottage food legislation went into effect. So I spent the next couple of months just studying as much as I could and reading as much as I could about cottage food all over the country, Colorado, Washington, California, Oregon, all these states have cottage food laws. There's some other great resources. Harvard did a really interesting study that summarizes a lot of the cottage food laws around the country and makes recommendations for expanded they make sort of health and safety recommendations, but then they also make recommendations for the economic impact and sort of improving this, improving the ability of small producers to go from, you know, small scale, maybe farmers markets, up to a sort of a second tier, which in this state we call cottage food. And then if they're successful there, taking it up to the next step of retail or wholesale food. And that got me here. And then I started, you know, I spoke at the Aero Conference, and now I'm on the Organic Gardener podcast.
Cool. All right. Well, you know, I think this is going to be really timely with all the Chipotles, you know, scare in the last couple of days. So I'm kind of glad, you know, it's good timing. And I'm sure listeners are going to be really curious about a lot of things that you've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So, and even I'm kind of curious because, you know, there's always those things that we're always wondering about. What do I do with this? Like when a light bulb breaks or like batteries, do I throw them in the garbage? Like people are always kind of wondering about that kind of stuff.
Right.
So maybe you'll have a few answers about those questions if we get there. All right.
Yeah.
So do you want to tell us about the new cottage food, what is it, an initiative or bill or in Montana? It's a bill, right?
So it was, if we think back to our, what were those songs that we listened to in elementary school that were, you know, it starts as a bill.
Oh, yeah, Schoolhouse Rock.
Schoolhouse Rock, right.
I love those. Yeah.
So it started out as House Bill 478. And House Bill 478 actually did a lot of things to affect food laws in Montana. But one of the, I think probably the biggest thing that it did was it took what was considered an illegal practice, and that was the practice of producing all sorts of things, but we'll call them cottage foods in your home kitchen, and then selling them. And I have a specific definition in my mind of what retail sales mean, but selling them as retail in retail sales. So retail sales at our level means the direct sale to an individual. So if I make it and I sell it to you, that's a retail sale. And that has a legal definition. But in the past, you could sell a lot of these things at a farmer's market. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to go to a bazaar, like a Christmas bazaar or a fair or a, you know, any other sort of public event, you would have had to have gotten a license to sell those same things. So if I were to bake an apple pie, for example, before House Bill 478, mm-hmm. I could sell that apple pie at a farmer's market, and I wouldn't need a license. I didn't need a license. There was no oversight at all. And then after what House Bill 478 has done is it has allowed people to take that apple pie that they could in the past just sell at a farmer's market, and now they can take that apple pie and sell it under this cottage food umbrella outside of farmer's markets. So again, at fairs, at Christmas bazaars. And what they would need to do is register that product with their local health department. And once they've done that, they're free to sell it anywhere in Montana, as long as it's a face-to-face sale.
Okay, I was just going to say, now, wasn't there a clause that it had to be, you had to be there collecting the money in person, and the person had to be handing you the money, so you can't, like, have somebody else sell it?
Yep, exactly. So it needs to be you as the individual. So if you're making apple pies, you register that apple pie with the health department, you take that apple pie, and you go sell it to me, right? And I give you $5 or $10 or whatever for your apple pie.
Or 20. I just went to the store yesterday, and this lady wanted $20 for pies, and I thought, wow, that's a lot of money.
It better be a pretty good apple pie for $20.
That's what my husband and I were wondering. We're like, do people sell pies for $20? Is that like a going rate, or like, are we just out of the loop? Or
I don't know. That seems high to me, but I haven't bought a pie in a while, so I don't know. But
I was thinking those Marie Callender ones you buy like in the supermarket are like $9 or $10, but $20 for a pie, I don't know. It sounded like a lot. Probably
are
she's
they nine,
a restaurant
they're nine or
and
ten
maybe.
Bucks?
Thinking of selling it like by the slice mostly.
Yeah. So, you know, you can, you make a good point. As long as it's the face-to-face sale, you're, you can do it anywhere in Montana. The other big question we get, internet sales. So you can advertise on the internet, but again, because of that requirement for the face-to-face sale, you can't sell it over the internet. You can say, I'm going to be at, you know, you can go on Facebook and say, you know, I've registered my apple pie and I'm going to be selling it the county fair. And you can go down there and set up a booth and sell it. So,
or I'm going to meet you at the, you know, grocery store or something even, right? As long as you...
Yeah. Because,
you know, a lot of Facebook groups anymore, like, you know, those classifieds, like, you know, mm-hmm. and that would be a place I would think a lot of people would want to start out.
Yeah. What the law says is, you know, this is a Montana specific law, so it's anywhere in Montana. It's limited to that face-to-face sale. And the way I describe it to people is sort of as a pyramid. So if you think of, in the past we had farmers markets, mm-hmm. and farmers markets, you could sell a specific set of food. It's listed in the farmers market laws. These non-potentially hazardous foods, you could go down to the farmers market and sell those foods. And there was no oversight. You can make it in your home kitchen, no regulatory oversight. And then if you want to sell outside of the farmer's market, mm-hmm. you have to register that food. So there's a little bit more regulatory oversight. We're looking at that food to see if it's a non-potentially hazardous food, which means that it's sort of a low-risk food. It's not as...
Do you want to tell us the list? Wasn't there like a list, like a short list or anything?
Yeah, I can read you the list in a second.
Okay. Yep.
So the that middle tier is a little bit more regulatory oversight because you have an expanded market. So if hypothetically you made something that was going to get people sick, you could get that out to more people. So we see that as a higher risk. And we want to have a little bit more oversight. And then the final tier is retail and wholesale sales, and that has the most regulatory oversight. And again, that's because it is, you can sell more stuff, you can sell potentially hazardous foods, and you're going to impact the most people. But let me, if you give me a second here.
Sure.
Let me just pull up the list. And we can kind of go through.
The other thing I wanted to, wasn't there something about when you register, mm-hmm. you wanted to register like all your recipes at one time, because otherwise you had to pay the fee per recipe. Whereas if you registered like 10 recipes on the same day, you only had to pay one fee.
Yeah. So, I will say, yes, you're right. There's what it says is when you register your products, you pay a $40 fee. So you could hypothetically register as many products as you wanted in a, in one registration packet. There's no limit. The thing I would say to be a little bit careful of is a lot of these local health, the local health departments are doing this review. And since this law went into effect on October 1st, you know, most people are submitting 1 to 10 products. Mm-hmm. But we've gotten a couple in where people have identified that sort of loophole, and mm-hmm. they have submitted, like the one I heard about, I've heard about two really big ones. Somebody submitted 90 products at once, and then somebody else submitted 150. So technically that's legal. You can do all that for the $40. But it really puts a strain on the resources of your local health department. And it makes it, it just makes them, they have to look at all those recipes. And so it just makes it tough for them.
Imagine how tough it'd be for someone to come up with 90 times $40.
Yeah.
I guess if they're not really, like, maybe they're just submitting them and thinking someday I'm going to make this. They're not actually making, is that what you're thinking?
I'm not sure. I'm just sort of suggesting that I think when this was written, I think it was intended that, you know, people would be reviewing up to maybe like 30 recipes at a time. Mm-hmm. And then when you're doing 90, that's taking, it's just a strain on resources. Mm-hmm. I get that, you know, if you really are going to produce 150 products, you know, it's totally legal. You can totally, I'm not saying don't do it. It's just something to consider. Especially the smaller jurisdictions have like one environmental health specialist, one, and I use that term interchangeably, an environmental health specialist and sanitarian. They just have one person who's doing septic permits and retail food reviews and pool inspections and body art inspections, and they're doing the cottage food stuff. And so then if they're also doing 150, I guess I would say not necessarily don't do it, but just be aware that if you're submitting 150 at a time, it might delay how quickly they can get that approval back to you. Right. That makes sense?
Yeah. I was just okay. thinking they could add up quick. I mean, my husband makes like probably a dozen different cookies at Christmas every year. And then, you know, if he was going to do like pickles and, or wait, decanting, I forgot, but I don't know. And then he's got bread. I don't know. It just seems like it could add up pretty quick. But 30 or 20 or I don't know, 150 is a lot. That's a lot of baking.
Yeah. And I don't know.
Can't imagine
details.
What that would all be.
I know. That's kind of what I was thinking. I was thinking, like, you know, if you specialized in breads or baked goods or something like that, you'd maybe have, I don't know, 5 or 6 breads and 10 cookies that you do and maybe a few other things, and then you're up to, you know, 15 to 20.
Yeah, that does seem a lot.
But anyways, that's okay. It's just something to consider when you submit it. Like, if you're going to submit 150, just be aware that that's going to take this, especially if you're in like a rural or a small county where they have limited resources already, it's just going to take that person a little bit longer to get that review done. So, but I got the list up if you want me to.
Okay.
I can go through those products.
Sure.
Okay. So, and I said this at the Aero conference, there's not a great way to do this, so I'll just read through these. The first thing that, and I probably should have said this at the outset, but the thing to consider here is all these products are what we call non-potentially hazardous foods, which means that they have, the technical definition means that they have a low water activity, and or a low pH, and if you test these foods over time, they don't grow pathogenic bacteria. I'll say they don't grow pathogenic bacteria well, and so that's why these are approved. And so then going through them, we got the first category is baked good products. And we have loaf breads, rolls, biscuits, quick breads and muffins, cakes, pastries or scones, cookies or bars, crackers, cereals, trail mixes or granola, nut and nut mixes, snack mixes, and pies. There is an exception to the pies, and that's custard-style pies. And then pies, and this has been a little bit confusing for people, so I'll explain it after I say it, but pies with fresh fruit that is unbaked, or pies that require refrigeration after baking. So the fresh fruit part, people read that pies with fresh fruit and they think that pies with fresh fruit aren't allowed. So the thing I tell them is you can obviously put fresh fruit into your pie and then bake it. What we don't want is just like a baked pie with fresh fruit added afterwards, because then that fresh fruit doesn't get the cook step.
Okay.
The next category is dried fruits. After that, we have jams, jellies, preserves, and fruit butters. The next category is recombining and packaging of dry herbs, seasonings, or mixtures. So this might be dry soup, teas, coffees, spice seasonings. So if you've got a great seasoning mix or something like that, you can put that together and have that be a cottage food. Popcorn balls, cotton candy, fudge. Candies or confections that require a cook step and do not require refrigeration after cooking. Molded chocolates using commercial chocolate milks, honey. And then the last category is other products may be approved on a case-by-case basis by the department in consultation with the local health authority. So that last category, what we were kind of trying to do was kind of say, you guys are the really creative ones. You guys are the ones that come up with these great new recipes for things. And we can't think of all those things and mm-hmm. put them in a list. So if you come up with something new that's a non-potentially hazardous food, we have a mechanism to approve that product. It just needs to, it's not on the list. So, you know, we'll take a look at it here at the state instead of at the local health, at the local level. And then we'll approve that. And as long as it's non-potentially hazardous.
Okay. And that's where I think you said, like I had asked about salad dressing, because that was something mm-hmm. I wanted to make, was a salad dressing. And then I think I asked about, my husband always wanted to have pickles if we had a farm stand. He thought pickles would be good. And I think you said that would go in there too, right?
This is, people always get mad at sanitarians because we always say it depends. It depends on a lot of things. I could envision a scenario where we would approve a salad dressing or a pickled product. The list, those things are not included in that list. Mm-hmm. So that would need to be, approved on a case by case basis. And we'd look at, whether or not that was non-potentially hazardous or not.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. And then what about eggs?
So eggs are allowed. You can still sell, or you could always and still sell those at farmers markets. Eggs, that's on the exempt list at farmers markets. So you can take that down to your farmers market on Saturday, or I know a lot of localities are having farmers markets. They used to just be Saturdays, but now, you know, you can get to them on Tuesday nights and all throughout the week. So those are exempt and allowed for sale at farmers markets, but they're not included in cottage food.
Oh, they're not. So, like, if somebody puts a sign up on the bulletin board that says, you know, organic eggs for sale, that's not okay?
So, and I don't want to put my foot in my mouth, because there are exemptions through the Department of Livestock for small producers of eggs.
Well, we could put the link in the show notes maybe later. You could find it and email it to me.
And that'd be a question to talk to DLI about. The interesting thing about eggs is the requirement for sales of eggs is pretty low. You have to become an egg grader. And becoming an egg grader is kind of a cool thing that I would recommend to people anyways. DLI has a program where they either permit or license egg graders. And basically, to sell eggs, you need to get that that egg to get beyond farmers markets and things. You need to have that egg grader. Again, I can't remember if they call it a permit or a license, but it's kind of a cool process where you're able to really look at the quality of your eggs, and it's not complicated. It's have you heard of egg candling?
Yes.
Okay, so that's it. That's what they do, is they just make sure you can candle an egg to their liking, basically. So looking for cracks and deficiencies within the egg and things like that.
And what are you calling a DOI or D?
Department of Livestock. Okay. So, and I think they're DOL.
Oh, okay.
We deal with a lot of acronyms here, and I internally on a day-to-day basis, we throw around hundreds of acronyms probably, and I always forget when I'm talking to people outside of the agency, I need to dial back the acronym. So it's Department of Livestock, and there's an Egg and Milk Bureau within the Department of Livestock, and they will license you to grade eggs, and I think it's a, I want to say it's a $25 fee or something like that, and they'll license you to be an egg grader. And it seems like kind of a neat process, so I'd kind of recommend it if you're getting into eggs and chickens and things like that.
So then, like, do you go take a class? Like, how do you learn about it?
I don't know. It's Department of Livestock's deal, but the stuff I've seen on it, I think, is kind of neat. So I would, and let me actually, I can pull up their contact information.
Okay. I found it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It looks like it's like $25, $20 for one part and $5 to be the grader.
Okay.
What about milk? Do you want to talk to us about milk at all?
Oh, milk. What is there something specific? So again,
well, wasn't there something about you couldn't put milk from your own cow on your baked products? It had to be pasteurized milk from the.
Yes. So basically, in the state of Montana right now, raw milk is illegal. And so if you're going to, sell a product, we ask that you use pasteurized milk and not raw milk.
What about cheeses? Oh, they're probably potentially hazardous because they got to be refrigerated.
Yeah. So the thing I tell people is, and this isn't perfect, so, you know, you kind of have to ferret things out, but if you have to refrigerate something for quality, it's probably a potentially hazardous food. So it doesn't work out 100% of the time, but if you're sticking it in the refrigerator so that it doesn't, like cheese is a great example, or milk will spoil, you know, if you leave it on the table, things like that, you need to refrigerate them. That's probably a potentially hazardous food and would not be included in cottage food. It's kind of a good rule of thumb to use.
An interesting thing about that, somebody was just telling me the other day, most countries don't refrigerate their eggs. And that eggs technically don't have to be refrigerated. That's been something I've been having a hard time wrapping my head around with our fresh eggs, because I'm always like, get those in the fridge right away. And my husband's like, technically, they don't really have to be in the fridge. And another friend of mine was giving me some flack about that, too. She's like, you know, that's just an American thing.
Yeah, I've heard the same thing. I would say the official guidance from the FDA is to keep eggs below 45 degrees Fahrenheit to prevent salmonella growth. Mm-hmm. But I've heard similar things. Like in Australia, I think I heard from a friend that if you go, the eggs aren't white. They're dirty. They look dirty. Yep. And the claim that was made, and this is totally unscientific, and I don't know if this is backed up by anything, but the claim that was made was that sort of the good bacteria keeps the bad bacteria at bay. I don't know if that's true or not, and I would, as a public health professional, reiterate that the FDA's recommendation for below 45 degrees Fahrenheit to maintain your eggs.
That's interesting, because somebody asked me about that once. They're like, you're not supposed to wash the eggs, right? And I was like, what are you talking about? You're not supposed to wash the eggs, but maybe that's why.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just heard that that's done in some other countries. We definitely I mean, you see the eggs that are sold in the store.
Yeah.
There's things that we know. I believe the number is 1 in 20,000 eggs sold commercially is contaminated with salmonella. There's nothing we can necessarily do about that other than, cook those eggs well and keep them. That's why the FDA has that recommendation, is if it's contaminated with salmonella and it's kept under refrigeration, the salmonella will be there, but it won't be there in it won't be growing, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in the egg, but it's not growing. And then the other FDA recommendation is that we cook our eggs thoroughly, which I know is hard. I like runny eggs too.
Oh, you do? I'm the total opposite. I'm like, cook them as hard and well done as you can. Yeah, I like them like fried.
Yeah, I've been eating over easy eggs since I was, I don't know, really little, and I still love them. Mm-hmm. Last night we had, for dinner, we had quinoa with sautéed kale and an over easy egg right on top. And I love just breaking it open and eating it that way. But that's not the FDA's recommendation for safety, and especially if you have young children or immunocompromised folks, I would really highly recommend cooking them thoroughly.
And, you know, I thought somebody told me once, too, that that's where the salmonella is actually on the shell. It's not the egg, and that's how it gets in. That's why you're supposed to bake it or cook it really hard, because it's when you crack it. And it touches the outside of that shell is where it actually comes from. I don't know how true that is, but somebody told me that. I could.
Yeah, that for a long time, that was what everyone said and thought. And what they found probably only between 5 and 7 years ago is that if you have, I think it's if you have a chicken that is infected, the salmonella can actually get into the that embryo there.
Okay.
Yeah. So it can be either, but.
Yeah. Okay. Did you want to talk at all about didn't you talk about if people wanted to have a food truck or something that went from fair to fair or anything like, did I forget anything here or we're good here?
No, that's a great thing. So I was kind of talking about House Bill 478 and how that became law and changed this cottage food dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But if I go back to House Bill 478, I did mention that it changed a number of things about retail food.
Mm-hmm.
So the other things that it changed were the mobile food regulations. So when you talk about a food truck, that's what we're talking about, is a what we call it here is a mobile food operator.
Okay.
And then it also significantly changed what we used to call a temporary food license, and we now call a temporary food permit, which I know sounds like a bureaucratic nonsensey thing, but that's the way it's phrased in the law now. So those are two different things, and they're ways that you can kind of expand what you want to sell. So we talked about cottage food being these non-potentially hazardous products. And then if you want to get into these things, like you mentioned cheeses, or if you want to do maybe some more just complicated menu items, then we ask you to get into retail food or wholesale food. And two subsets of that are temporaries and mobile food establishments. So a mobile food establishment, what House Bill 478 did is it asked us to standardize how mobile food establishments are reviewed throughout the state. And then that's always been a statewide license. But in the past, Sometimes what was reviewed in one county wasn't accepted in another county because of like local ordinances and things like that. So House Bill 478 kind of made it required that, you know, if you're approved to sell hamburgers via a mobile food truck, you can drive anywhere in the state and do that. There's always, I always say this, and I mentioned it earlier, there's always little caveats to all these things, but in general, that's a true statement. And then what it did for temporary events is it expanded that a little bit. So say you have, in the past, you could only get a temporary event license that lasted, I think it was 10 days. So let's say you wanted to sell, I'm trying to think of a good example here.
I want to sell burritos.
Okay, perfect. You want to sell burritos, and you want to sell your burritos every Saturday all year long at the farmer's market, because that's people at the farmer's market love your burritos. So before House Bill 478, there was a law that said if you're going to do a temporary, if you're going to get a temporary event license, that event license is only good for 10 consecutive days. The problem with that, right, is if you get your event license to start maybe on a Saturday, that'll take you through to the next Saturday. But if you want to do the Saturday after that, you have to get another temporary event license. And the other problem with that is, which, you know, maybe isn't a huge deal, except that every temporary event license was, depending on the size of your operation, between $85 and $115.
Wow.
And so, you know, if you're on the high end of that and you want to do every Saturday, you know, for even just for the summer, you're probably looking at like $1,000 in licensing fees, which I think everybody agreed was unreasonable.
Yeah, especially in Eureka.
Yeah, right. You know, everyone agreed it was unreasonable, but that's what the law said, was, you know, this is what had to happen. And so if you were going to follow the law, you paid these sort of exorbitant fees. Not sort of exorbitant, I would say very exorbitant fees. What they did was they moved the permitting locally, and they expanded the time that a permit lasts. So now you can have 45 non-consecutive days.
Nice.
So if you wanted to, so that kind of gets you through most of the year, really, if you're doing, again,
a
this
weekly
is a temporary, it's a temporary event license. So it's not intended to be full scope, you know, restaurant style or even mobile food establishment, where those guys invest quite a bit more into their business, but it can really expand the operation, and then that 45 days is still, well, depending on what county you're in, it's $115 maximum. And then a lot of counties are actually, some of them are still, they're allowed to charge up to that $115. And so you'd have to talk to your local county to figure out what that fee is. But I know a number of them have created these sort of scaled fees. I think up in Flathead County now, you can, if you're just doing one, like you want to do one farmer's market, but you want to do it for, say, let's say, for, you know, the total 45 Saturdays, that would cost I think about $25 in Flathead County now. So we went from, you know, possibly $1,000, and that wouldn't even get you through 45 days, to 25. So I think it's a, I would say
it's going to help build some jobs.
I agree. Yep.
Create some jobs, get some people working and being able to be inventive and innovative and start some businesses and some things like that. What about, speaking of businesses that have recently been started, what about like lip balms and lotions and stuff? Does that, I guess lotions wouldn't come under food. Lip balms probably don't either. What am I thinking about? Never mind.
Yeah, neither one of those are really something that we look at. We do product recalls here in this office. Yeah. So we help coordinate those. So, you know, if there was a lip balm recall, we would help coordinate that locally to get that off store shelves and things like that. But it's not something that's licensed or regulated by this office.
Okay. You know what I was going to ask you? I was thinking back on the recipes and what is considered, non-potentially hazardous food. Wasn't there something about labeling? Like it had to have a couple of specific things on the labeling. Like it had to have the ingredients, but not the procedure.
Yeah.
And so, it had to say it's made by you in a homemade kitchen or something. I don't know. You tell us.
Yep. No, you got it. I mean, you nailed it. You listened to my speech really well.
At I the take Aero good conference. Notes.
Yeah, good. So you've got it exactly right. So if you're these cottage food products, just for consumer awareness, the actually not our rules, but what the state legislature asked was that those have a label on them. And the label has, so if you're, you know, cottage foods are small enough, there's federal labeling requirements, but that require like nutrition facts and things like that. But cottage foods are going to be small enough that they're not going to be required to do the nutrition facts. What they are going to be required to do is have a statement that says made, let me look this one up real
quick. Okay, while you're looking that up, I'm going to tell listeners about this great app called MyFitnessPal. And not only does it track your calories and your exercise, but you can enter a recipe in there and it will give you all that info. It tells you how many how many servings, and you put in like, you know, a cup of flour and 3 cups of sugar, whatever you're doing. You know, I've entered a lot of Mike's recipes in there to see how much his cookies, which have like 133 calories in a cookie. His muffins have like 350 calories in one muffin. And I'm like, oh my goodness. But anyway, it tells you all the nutrition facts and stuff. So, and it's free. MyFitnessPal also helps you lose weight. If you follow its instructions, if you follow what it does. It's been the best app for me, but I have a hard time following it sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't get enough exercise.
My wife and I have both used FitnessPal, and I would just reiterate what you said. I think it's a great app. So what the label says, the label has to say is made in a home kitchen that is not subject to retail food establishment regulations or inspections. And then it has to have a statement of what it is. So chocolate chip cookies is an example. And then it has to have the net weight. And then it needs the ingredients in order of, I guess, volume or weight. So like, you know, if the biggest ingredient that you put in was flour,
right.
Then that'd be your first ingredient and so on down the line. And maybe the smallest ingredient that you used was walnuts or something, then that'd be the lowest. And then the last part, it would be your address, and that would be at the bottom of the label. And it would just say, and that's so that if somebody does get sick or has an allergic reaction or something like that, they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, and you did say that, like, that then what they would do is kind of come check out your area and maybe give you some suggestions for what you can do better, or like maybe require you to do something cleaner or different. But like, it wasn't like a, it didn't seem like as scary of a thing as when I first was like, what? But you kind of made it sound like it wasn't, they were going to just out to help you succeed. Like the whole thing of this cottage bill that I really liked is hearing is that I think they're trying to help people succeed and help people, encourage people to try getting into the business of, you know, and different ways to help farmers grow and get their products to market. So you have something maybe to get you through those winter months that are a little bit harder and give, you know, just give them more ways to find to sell your products. And another thing I was thinking is this woman, Joyce Pinson, who came on my show from Kentucky, talked about the biggest way to improve sales at farmers markets is to cook right there at the market. Like she would cook zucchinis and teach people how easy it is to cook a food. And she just had this little like home. And she said, you know, you have to take this class on how to cook in public or something. But she said it was really easy, just a few hours about safe food handling. And she said that will make a huge difference if you want to sell products at a farmer's market is to have something. And that was remember my husband, he said he wanted to have pickles there. So, and that was the other thing I remember the takeaway from that day too, was that, sorry, my alarm just went off and I lost my train of thought. Okay. So people were raising concerns about submitting their recipes to the department because they had to put their procedure down and they were worried that somebody was going to get their secret recipe from great grandma. And you said that the department, you know, keeps all that private and they're not going to find, you don't have to put the procedure on the label. You don't have to do that part. They'll keep it confidential. So if people are worried
absolutely.
About that.
So that's right in the law. It's illegal for the local or state health departments to reveal that information to the public. So as I just said, you have to put what's in it onto your label, and that's for like consumer safety, consumer protection. But as far as like how you process it, you need to submit that to the health department so they can kind of parse some of those things out and make sure you've got some basic things in place to protect people's health. excuse me. But once you've submitted that, you can be assured that, you know, it is illegal for the health department to share the procedural information of like how you combine that ingredient, those ingredients, how you cook those ingredients, how long you cook those ingredients. All of that stuff is sort of trade secret information, and it's protected in the cottage food law. So I'll give an example. So probably every day we get wholesale food submittals, wholesale food license application submittals, and we have a locked cabinet here at the office. And we keep everything, all those, barbecue sauce recipes, things like that, we keep them locked away so that, you know, that's not shared. It's all encrypted. Anything on the computer regarding that stuff is in, like, encrypted files and things like that. So that's how we do it at our office. And then locally they're going to have similar things in place to prevent people from accessing those procedural things.
All right. Well, is there anything else? I mean, we're at an hour already. I thought this was going to be a short interview, but wow, I've been really talking. And I really think listeners are going to like it. So it's been full of information. And it's funny, my podcasting partner who helps me with my, you know, do my podcast, he knows somebody, I can't remember if it's his sister or a friend of his, that does what you do in the state of California. So might be able to get her to come on and talk to us about what's going on in California too. But he was interested when I said, I'm going to interview this guy about this. And so
It's really interesting. All the states right now are handling this a little bit differently. And I'd be actually really interested if you do get that person from California on to kind of hear. I've read about what they do, but it's always hard to kind of, it's easier to hear it. It's sometimes hard to read the regulations and figure out, okay, well, how's that actually, you know, I think if I read California's laws right, they have, I don't think you register individual products, but you do have to attend some courses on producing food safely and things like that. So, and then you're limited, I think, to certain types of products. So it'd be really interesting to see or to hear what, if you do get California on, what they do. I had, oh, the one other thing I wanted to mention.
Okay.
Was, you submit your registration, and once that's approved, you'll get a certificate from our office, which it's required in the law that you have if you're selling products to the public. So you have that on you when you're going to sell the products. And then the other thing I wanted to mention, so keep that certificate with you. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was there's no inspections associated with this. So you'll register your product, and there's the health department is not going to come to your house and like inspect your home kitchen. So that's the other thing I wanted to really make clear here. The only time anybody would possibly do an inspection is if there's been an outbreak that's directly associated, you know, there's evidence of an outbreak that's been directly associated with something that you produce.
And that's where you said that they would come and just help you pretty much for the future.
I mean, generally speaking, that's, I would say, what would happen. I've got all these what ifs going through my mind, but generally speaking, if something goes wrong, your health department's going to come in and say, hey, you know, you need to change this. Here's where the cross contamination is happening. Cause you've got your egg bath or your egg mix right here, right next to where you're, you know, wrapping the cookies up and putting the label on them, and you're getting, you know, you have contaminated eggs or something. I don't know, but they would work with you on your process and try to get that corrected. So, so no inspections unless something really goes wrong, and then the first thing the health departments are likely going to do is work with you to correct the process as opposed to. It's very rare, I would say, that any license or registration or permit is ever revoked by our department or local health departments. They usually try to work with people, and unless there's like a really egregious violation, and then.
And that's like you're doing something wrong. You're not doing what you said you were going to do, probably,
exactly.
Or something besides.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, there was one I heard about the other day where there was just, this was a retail establishment, and it was like, I was just going to say, you know, an example of like a really egregious violation. There was one the other day that I got a phone call on. There was a rodent infestation and, you know, rodent droppings all over a kitchen, and this is a licensed establishment, and so the local health department closed that establishment temporarily until they could eradicate the infestation and clean up all the droppings. So even in that case, it's like the restaurant isn't getting closed for good. It's just, you know, clean this stuff up, and then we'll open you back up. So, you know, again, if there's egregious violations, they're going to work with you. And this is an example at a licensed establishment where they say, you know,
that reminds me of two things. One's the Bruce Almighty movie, you know, where, like, I don't know if you've seen that, but he starts out in the beginning and the lady's like, yeah, we're doing this good thing for the community because our kitchen got shut down because they saw a rat dropping, which wasn't, it was a rat. They're just funny. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing reminds me of, like, when I first got out of high school, I had this job and this friend of mine that worked with me, she got a new job at this other insurance agency, and her job was she constantly was getting was for people who found like something in their candy bar or something, like she's like, not believe the food I mean, there is not a food on the market that you're gonna buy that somebody has not found a mouse in or a bone in or something. Like, it might sound gross, but apparently, like, this is very commonplace. She just, I couldn't, some of the stories I heard from her were just funny.
So,
if people are going, ew, I can't believe it, like, it happens a lot more than you think.
Yeah, we have an anonymous complaint system, and the things that we hear, I mean, in the story, if you get a sanitarian to sit down with you, they've got some stories. The thing I will say is, like, 99% of the places that we go out and inspect are doing a great job. They keep their facilities clean, you know, they're serving healthy, safe food. It's just that 1% that probably less than 1% that we worry about. So,
and, you know, I try to tell people, like, as a teacher, I would tell my kids a lot, and other teachers, like, a lot of people in the United States don't appreciate the fact that we have laws that say when you go in the bathroom and you see that sign there that says employees must wash their hands. That's a huge perk of living in the United States. And, like, a lot of countries don't have things like that. They don't have that knowledge. They don't even know about basic, you know, they're just, you know, that's like just different things like that, that, you know, we have procedures in our restaurants for how you're supposed to clean up at the end of the day. And just, you know, that's one of the good things about this country. I really like.
Absolutely. We have safe food. We have clean water. You don't on a day-to-day basis, you don't have to worry about those things. And I think it raises the bar in the United States, because, you know, you're not worried about getting sick from those things. And so you can spend your time, like you said, you know, innovating and working and leading a happy, healthy life.
Yeah. All right. So the other thing, can't mention California and not think, what about the medicinal marijuana products people are making? Do you guys do anything with that, or is that a different department? I'm sure somebody's wondering about that.
Well, it's in the Department of Public Health, but the Quality Assurance Division, which is a division, we're the Public Health and Safety Division, and then the Quality Assurance Division looks at medicinal marijuana in Montana. And I think they license or register all those stores. That's who would I guess you'd need to talk to if you're looking into medicinal marijuana in Montana.
Okay. All right. Well, anything else you want to share?
I don't think so. I think we covered just about everything. If I had to summarize this stuff, cottage food in general, I would just say I do think you hit the nail on the head when I believe you were saying something along the lines of this really kind of expands opportunities for people. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the intent of the law. And so I hope it goes that way in practice. And then I would just reiterate that rule of thumb that, you know, if you need to refrigerate the product, it's probably a potentially hazardous food and wouldn't fall under cottage food. But there's still ways to produce those products legally. It just, you need to go through that retail food or wholesale food process. So, you know, expanded job opportunities, increased, you know, increased market, and as long as we're sticking to the non-potentially hazardous foods, we should be good and everybody should be safe and happy and healthy.
Cool. Thanks so much, Ed.
Yeah.
And thanks for my mess up yesterday.
Oh, no worries. I've done it myself. So
your interview 97, and that's the first time that I was not home when my interview was supposed to start. I'm just deeply, like, all of a sudden I was like running in the woods with my dogs and my buzzer went off and said starting in 30 minutes. And I was like, what? 30 minutes? What am I doing? And like, I was 30 minutes from my car just there. And then my car is 30 minutes or 15, 20 minutes from my house. And I was like, ah. So
are you in Bozeman?
No, I'm in Eureka. North of Whitefish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
cool. That's a beautiful area.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Love that area. Yeah.
So, well, thanks. Yep. Well, thanks for coming on today and sharing with everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you? Well, maybe after the interview, I just wanted to ask: are you involved in? Are you a member of Arrow?
I am a member of Arrow now. I didn't know. So I tell people that, like, I've had my Arrow license plates since 2010 when I bought my little car and was flipping through the plates and was like, ooh, these are pretty. I like these. And I probably Googled the website, but didn't really, like, see much there. But then I had a guest on in the spring, Laura Behenna, who used to work for them. And so then I went back to their website. And then Jill Hill Hart, who had the blog this summer, and is now the executive director, I read her blog and just fell in love with it. And I've been in love with Arrow ever since. And then she came on the show and talked about the expo. And I was like, I'm going. so glad I went. And
They gave incredible input as we were drafting the rule and kind of, you know, we were going one way with a couple of things and they said, well, maybe you should go this way with it. And we corrected and I think it's a better law for it. So they did a great job. And I think we're in the future. I've talked to Jennifer a few times and we're looking forward to trying to work with them. I think Jennifer's planning some cottage food trainings.
Awesome.
So trainings to kind of get people into the specifics about like what you can produce, how you can produce it, and maybe some like hands-on. It sounded, you know, this is all, I don't want to put words in Jennifer's mouth, but it sounded like she was thinking of like hands-on classes where, you know, you actually get to make some of the products and, you know, make a label and do some of those things. And we're going to try to work with them as closely as possible to get that sort of stuff going and participate as much as we can.
Cool. I like that. Yeah, I'm going to try to get more involved. But yeah, I just love them. And I think Arrow's going to expand more. I think Jennifer's going to be a great director and leader and help get their message out, because I think the more people, I mean, I just was so in love at that meeting. I was like, oh my goodness, these are my peeps. These are the people that, how have I been in Montana all this time and not known all of you? And and just, it was like, you know, being home or something, or just really nice, really active, good people.
Good, good. Well, if you have any other questions, feel free to give me a call and I'll, you know, if stuff comes up after this airs, and, you know, people have specific questions, you can either send them to me or just, send me. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk to you more about questions that come up and things like that. So,
okay. I was going to say, how do we connect with you? Is there a way, like, is there an email or website or somewhere they can go, or just tell them to put it in the show notes, or?
Yeah, that'd be great. So our website, and we have a link to it just says cottage food up in the left-hand corner, and it'll get you the registration information and get you going.
Okay.
The shortcut to our website is FCSS, so that's Frank Charlie Sam Sam .mt.gov. And then my email is E Evanson, so EE, V as in Victor, ANSON, at MT.gov. And you have my phone number too.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.